Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact.
What does addressing climate change mean for the human race? What it actually means is the first global test on universal solidarity. That's what it means. And I'm very excited about that because I think that is the challenge of the 21st century.
My guest today is Christiana Figueres, an internationally recognized leader on global climate change. As Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, she led a global process culminating in the historic Paris Agreement in 2015. She is currently the convener of Mission 2020, a global initiative trying to bend the curve on greenhouse gas emissions in order to protect the most vulnerable from the worst impacts of climate change. Christiana, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite.
So tell us about the Paris Agreement. Why is it significant?
Would you like a one-minute answer or a three-year answer? You have to choose.
Tell us a little bit of both.
1.5-minute answer. I would say that the Paris Agreement is necessary and not sufficient to decarbonize the global economy, which means to put us on a path to a safe and certainly a much more just economy. It is necessary because what we now have is a universally agreed, exception the United States, but other than that, a universally agreed roadmap for decarbonizing the global economy over the next three decades. So one thing that is important to understand about the Paris Agreement is that it was not an agreement to determine what was going to happen in 2015. It's actually a roadmap all the way through to 2050, which is when scientists have said we actually have to be at net zero of carbon emissions. So it's basically a three-decadal route for the global economy. So that is necessary to understand and everybody to agree to what the route and particularly what the final destination is going to be. It is necessary, but it is not sufficient because any roadmap, any GPS, any business plan that is actually not followed is only as good as the paper that it stands on. And so that's what we're working on now, which is the timely implementation of the Paris Agreement.
So give us the goal, zero emissions by 2050, but we have some milestones along the
way.
Zero
net, and
right.
That little word is important.
Right.
Because I don't think that it is realistic to think, I mean, maybe, and I would be delighted to be wrong, but I, you know, every human activity has some kind of an impact. And you can't walk down the street without having an impact. So zero net, what that means is that we will have brought down our emissions to the point where all necessary and remnant emissions can be absorbed by the natural systems of the planet. So it's not zero emissions. It is definitely zero emissions from many sectors, but not from all. So it is zero net emissions.
Great. So human beings are notoriously bad in taking steps that are necessary in the long term but painful in the short term.
I actually think human beings are notoriously good human beings. That is my point of departure. If I didn't believe that, I could not get up in the morning. But carry on.
I mean, I happen to believe that human beings are inherently good and capable of greater good than are evil.
Indeed, we agree on that one.
But I think we need to incentivize them to take steps in the short term that may feel that they're giving something up or may feel as though they're painful for long-term benefit.
Well, yes, if you think that going to the gym is obviously painful for a long-term benefit. I happen to think that addressing climate change is not a sacrifice and is not painful. I actually think that that is a myth that is really important to puncture and put to bed. Because please don't tell me that having more livable cities with better transportation, with cleaner air, with more green space, that is all about decarbonizing the economy of an urban area. Is that painful? No, actually, that is an improvement in the quality of life. And so I think we really have to get over this idea that, you know, this is such a burden and it's such a sacrifice. And, you know, this country's not going to do it unless the other country's going to do it. Honestly, the motivation here should be absolutely out of self-interest. And you see this at city level. You see already many mayors, and I work with 9,000 mayors around the world, and you see them competing positively and constructively competing to decarbonize their cities because they know that they're making more livable cities and that citizens will be happier. And unfortunately, they will attract more citizens to their cities as though we didn't already have urbanization issues.
Well, now I'm feeling wildly optimistic
in just
7 minutes. So then let's zoom back and then we'll drill down at the sort of easy things that we can do in order to address climate. But let's zoom back for a moment. I think there's a lot of fuzziness about what the 4 or 5 things that need to be done precisely in order to meet our net zero emission goals. And there's a lot of like to have, but there are a couple, and I suspect you can rattle them off, as to what is essential, what we must do in order to get there.
So let me start with 5 things that every individual can and should do. And then we can also go to the systemic, because what we have to understand is this is both about individuals, but it is also about systemic change, and systemic change happens at the government and corporate level. But at the individual level, number one, what are we eating? And that is something that we can all change. So to those who are still eating red meat 7 days a week, your body is not happy. So this is not about sacrificing. This is about listening to your body and saying, okay, do you really want to stress your system every single day of the week? Or are you going to start going from 7 to 6 to 5 to 4, or, you know, as far as you want to go, to 0, hopefully, just giving up on red meat? Honestly, it's the easiest thing that you can do to improve your health. And of course, it contributes to the health of the planet. So, you know, to my point about we do have to change our behavior and our decisions, but it is not about something that is painful and certainly not something that is going to damage us. So, number one, what are you eating? Number two, take a look in your home, particularly in this wonderful city of London. If you're still living in a home that is inefficient, if you're still working out of a building that is inefficient, you are actually wasting an inordinate amount of energy. You're wasting a lot of money because in the winter, you are heating the entire neighborhood. And in the summer, you are cooling down the entire Hyde Park. Do you really want to do that? You can invest into isolating and really making your home so much more agreeable and so much more comfortable to live in and save money. Of course, you have to invest, but typically energy efficiency, you should be able to recoup that in a reasonable number of years. So what do you eat? Where do you live? Third, how do you transport yourself? London is a particularly, for those, I used to live in London. I love London. I miss it. And one of the things that I miss most about London is the fantastic public transport that we have here. And so, you know, it's particularly in developed country cities that have good transport, and that's not good public transport. And that's not the case in many developing countries. There is frankly no excuse to be using a car in cities that have good public transport. And if you have to use a car, then using one car for one person, it is just completely irresponsible. So how are you transporting yourself? You know, are you walking as much, which is also better for your health? Are you biking enough, which is also better for your health? And are you using public transport? Fourth, for those who are already at an age in which there is some already availability of disposable capital, where is that capital invested and saved? If your capital is invested in a fund or in any financial instrument that is still invested in fossil fuels and in high carbon, you're actually doing yourself a disfavor because all of those assets, that whole asset class, in fact, certainly coal, but even oil and gas, is losing value in the capital markets very quickly. So if you want to save your money in the long run, if you want to lose your money in the long run, be my guest. But if you want to be responsible about your money in the long run, take it out of high carbon. And finally, for those who live in democracies, that's my fifth point. For those who live in democracies, how are you voting? And that is actually, you know, a topic that is quite current, certainly in Europe with the EU Parliament, recently in India with that election, recently in Australia. And the fact that, you know, people understand that that climate is upon us and that it is the greatest threat, and then still vote against leaders who are trying to enact climate policy is something that is, frankly, outrageous.
So what you eat, where you live, how you transport yourself, what you invest, and how you vote. This seems like a very easy and attainable kind of menu of things that you ought to
be
doing.
Well, it's a good thing that you use the word menu, right? Because it doesn't mean that anyone has to turn into a little, you know, climate angel overnight. But since there are five things you can do, you can say, okay, well, you know, where do I start? And pick which one you start. You don't have to do all of them immediately, but there are enough personal decisions and behavior changes that we can all take that we can start with one, two, or three.
So let's presume we all invest and we all vote, and green governments take over the world, and green capital floods into the markets.
Green parties, by the way, were one of the, or the party that was most benefited by the EU Parliament elections. So, you know, good on Europeans getting there. Not quite where we should, but on the road.
So we've got green governments and green capital, and you are heading a green government with loads of green capital to access. Tell us now at a macro level what we need to do, where we need to invest, and what we need to stop doing, and what we need to proactively do.
So on the in the energy sector, which is 70% of the emissions, separated into electricity generation and transport, those are the first two because they are the most highly emitting. So we have to move over to renewable energy, ASAP. We're currently not bad on track, actually. We are at about a quarter of all electricity being produced worldwide is already renewable, so that's not bad. And we're on track to be at 50% by 2030. So that's not bad. I do celebrate, since we're sitting here in London, I do celebrate the fact that so many people have appreciated that there is no coal in the UK grid for, I think, like 2 weeks now. No coal. I mean, that is historic, right? We have to remember what coal meant to this country just 40, 30 years ago, and the fact that coal has been completely displaced out of the grid for now several weeks. And even when coal is there, it's a very, very minute percent. And why is that? Because it has been displaced by offshore wind. The UK has the best offshore wind source worldwide, combined with natural gas. So it's interesting to see that, you know, there's no one solution. You have to put a portfolio of different sources together. But in any event, so move over to renewable energies as quickly as possible. Follow the example of the United Kingdom. Secondly, transport. And we have seen, a pretty impressive uptake of electric vehicles, electric mobility, just in the past 2 to 3 years. Something that 10 years ago we would have thought was science fiction is actually now the norm in all car manufacturers. They have all moved over or have committed to moving over to electric vehicles. Some of them have said they're moving some models over. Others have said they're moving all of their models over. But you do see that we live in a different world when companies like Porsche, for example, such an iconic company, has said they're moving over all of their models over to electric vehicles, with the exception of the 911 that they will keep as their, you know, iconic model that they refuse to move over to electricity. So, you know, that's understandable. But everything else. So if you have a 911 sitting anywhere, you definitely have a museum piece, because that's going to be the only Porsche car that is not electric. But you know, you see really interesting, dramatic shifts. Like the fact that Porsche is moving, Volkswagen is moving everything over, and they're the ones that are investing most into battery technology in order to be able to accelerate their shift over to electric mobility. Of course, what else could they do after, you know, their emissions brouhaha? But you even have a company like Harley Davidson. So, you know, what is Harley Davidson known for? It is known for its combustion engine. It's very, very loud combustion engine. And so just imagine when you're going to have Harley Davidsons that are actually silent because they are electric. I mean, that is a different world, right? That is a completely different world. And so we're very quickly moving into a world that is dramatically different from the one that certainly that I grew up in. So that's electricity, that's transport. Land use. I would say land use does not have a good story to tell as electricity and vehicles for many different reasons that, you know, we don't need to get into now. But it is definitely a sector that is 30% of the problem and 30% of the solution. And if we healed our relationship with the land, if we regenerated degraded lands, if we reforested more than we are deforesting, if we moved over to sustainable agriculture, we would have 30% of the solution, and we would have much richer soils and much more fertile soils that would have much more food generating capacity. So, you know, something that has many, many different benefits. So that sort of takes care, I would say, of, you know, the bulk of emissions. Then there are some emissions that also come from the built environment, from, you know, buildings, et cetera, from heating, cooling, but they're taken up in the electricity. And you have emissions that come from heavy industry, which are the hardest to displace, although the Commission on the Hard-to-Abate Sectors has already come out with a very good plan on how that could be done. But fundamentally, all of this is based on three enabling pillars. Everything. One, shifting finance. Two, the advance of technology. And three, policy, enabling policy. And the quicker that we get finance, technology, and policy to work together, the quicker these shifts are going to occur.
So,
amen. That was quite a mouthful.
That's extraordinary. That. It's a masterclass. So, finance, tech, and policy. Which of those are you most optimistic about, and which are you most concerned about?
I don't think that's a helpful question, because if we could choose one or the other, then, you know, then you could choose your favorite, which is the winning horse. But the fact is that they all need each other. And the fact is that over different periods of time, if you look over the past 10 to 15 years, some or the others have taken more of a, let's say, an accelerated role. Right now, I think technology, certainly in electricity generation and in electric mobility, that being one of the possibilities for mobility, not the only, the technology there is moving very, very fast. That was not the case 10 years ago. The other piece that is beginning to move quite fast is finance, because the technologies are opening up investment possibilities. So obviously, you know, if there's an interesting investment possibilities, then capital flows toward that. So those two are very linked. And right now, I would say policy, international policy or national policy, is probably slower, but it wasn't 5 years ago, right? So when we adopted the Paris Agreement, it was policy that was driving this. So you see, it's actually a, I would say, a self...
an ecosystem.
Yeah, it's definitely an ecosystem, but it is a self-maturing and a mutually reinforcing, not circle, but rather a cycle that then moves. So, you know, we move from one level of these three interacting with each other, and then one of them takes three steps forward, and that brings the whole set up to the next level. And you have these constant improvement cycles because all three reinforce each other.
So let's zero in on policy for a moment. Again, simple terms, a really progressive, interesting Green Party captures the presidency in the United States and Congress and Senate. What are the three most important laws they could pass?
The three most in the U.S. Or anywhere. The three most important laws that they could pass, and this is totally, you know, green, as they say in German, grüner Tisch. So green table, I can do anything I want, even if it's not realistic. I love it. Okay, so without any consideration of political realism, the first most powerful measure that any government can take is putting a price on carbon, whether that is through a tax or whether that is through, you know, any kind of version of tax, and there are many different, or whether that is through an emissions trading system. We have 60 jurisdictions around the world. 40 of them have emissions trading systems, and 20 of them have a tax. And it doesn't really matter which you pick. It just depends on the particular characteristics of your national economy. But putting some price, whichever way you want to go, putting a price on carbon, and putting a price that actually escalates over time. Because industry does have to get a very clear signal that they're being met where they are, but that there are increasing expectations of decarbonization as time goes on and as technology matures. So for me, honestly, you know, putting a price on carbon is probably my choice number one and my choice number two. It is that important. And then everything else sort of comes in behind that. Obviously, energy efficiency regulations would help enormously. Any incentives on renewable energy coupled with the removal of subsidies on fossil fuels. You know, there's a lot of complaint about the subsidies for renewables, but everybody seems to have forgotten that we have decades of subsidies for fossil fuels, so removal of fossil fuel subsidies, and any kind of incentive for renewables that doesn't need to be a subsidy anymore because they're so competitive. That would come in third place if I've already occupied places one and two.
So you've set forth how...
And better transport, public transport, better, you know, urban design so that we can enjoy the city. Because cities should... And 60% of the urban space that we're going to need on this planet hasn't even been built yet or conceived. So there's a huge opportunity to design this urban space for people, because it is actually people who live in cities. It's not necessarily cars, bridges, roads, and buildings, which is what cities are designed for now. It is about people-centered cities.
So help us think about, on the one hand, we're trying to reduce emissions to net zero. On the other hand, there's a lot of discussion about drawing down, not just stopping emissions, but actually seeking to draw down. How important is drawdown in the overall equation? What hope do you have that there are meaningful drawdowns that can be achieved? And if you are hopeful, what might those be?
The drawdown universe is divided into two big families. The first family is what I would call the natural carbon capture and sequestration, which is a, you know, ancient technology, proven throughout the ages, doesn't have any negative effects. You know, why we're not using that more is beyond my comprehension. And that proven technologies is trees. The fact that we're continuing to deforest more than we are reforesting is absolutely criminal to the atmosphere. It's criminal to biodiversity, it's criminal to our aquifers, it's, you know, it just makes absolutely no sense to the richness of the soil. So for me, the number one drawdown is planting more trees, regenerating the land, all those, that whole family, I would say, of activities that put carbon back where it belongs. Because if you think about this, right, it's all about, it's what we're talking about. Climate change is all about real estate. Okay, that's what it's all about. Real estate is all about location, location, location. Where are you located? Climate change is the same thing. Where is the carbon located? If the carbon is located in the air, that is not correctly placed. That is totally misplaced and toxic if it's in the air. If the carbon is back where it belongs, which is in the soil, that's where all these fossil fuels come from. Let's remember, we dig them up, right? And then we burn them and we put them in the air. That is completely, you know, that is against all natural laws. We have to be able to bring the carbon out of the air and put it back into the soil where it belongs. That is the location of carbon. And putting carbon back into the soil has many, many different benefits. So all of those natural carbon capture, sequestration, I want to call them technologies, but you understand that it's actually all natural growth. All of that is totally number one. Then you have a whole other family of drawdowns, as you call them, or carbon capture or sinks or whatever you want to call them, that are being experimented with and that are not very proven yet for their safety, for their permanence, and certainly still very expensive, which is everything to do with industrial carbon capture and storage, which is a technology that is being developed to industrially capture CO2 and put carbon or CO2, in fact, into geologically sealed sites or, other hopefully safe harbors. That technology is still in development and it's very, very expensive. And so we might have to resort to that a few decades from now, but we can't count on it right now because it's too expensive. And is just not at the scale or price that is needed for the task that we have at hand.
Do you think there is a point at which there's a sort of the notion of feedback loops and irreversibility as sort of things that scare people existentially, and it might be a very unhelpful concept because in some ways it can cause people to kind of give up hope. But do you think, it's real, and B, the sort of pursuit of these sort of killer technologies are things that we should pursue nevertheless to give us a back stop if in case we were to be in a kind of feedback world?
Yeah, what do you call killer technologies?
Well, I mean, some of the second family of sort of industrial level drawdowns that could do it at a kind of at a scale that is beyond
our... I wouldn't call them killer technologies, well, right? Because they they could save us, in fact.
I don't mean killer. I should say the opposite, existential technology.
I do think it's important to invest in them and to continue the development of them because there are quite a few scenarios under which we will, as scientists, call it overshoot. So we now know that that we have to be on a track to get to arrest the warming to 1.5 degrees over pre-industrial temperatures. And there's a very clear path for that, which is to be at one half of the global emissions that we have right now, cut that to half by 2030, another half by 2040, and then the final half by 2050. And that would get us to a total of 5 because we started 40. So 40 to 20 to 10 to 5. And hopefully 5 gigatons is what we can naturally absorb. So that's a very clear pathway. Now, if we're able to do that, and there are actually very good very good arguments why we will be able, or at least would be able to do that, then we're okay. But if we don't follow that pathway, if we veer from that pathway, and we are not cutting down at that pace of 50% every 10 years, then we would do something that scientists call overshoot, and we would have too many emissions for the moment of time in which we're living. For that overshoot, we probably will need to resort to technologies like that one.
I want to ask a question about genetics and genetic modification. I recently listened to a talk from people at the Salk Institute who are doing genetic engineering of the roots of plants, in increasing the output of suberin. They believe that they can engineer a generation of plants that will be able to draw down four times the amount of carbon that a regular plant will be able to do, take it, as you say, from the atmosphere and put it into the soil. Now, this is both natural and a technology. And those people who are involved in the green movement are sort of historically ambivalent around genetic engineering and genetic modification. Help us think through how we should think about this to the extent that it actually helps us in relation to climate change.
Well, I'm not sure that there's a, you know, a clear answer on that one. I'm not sure that there's a black and white. First, I should say I know absolutely nothing about genetic engineering. So, you know, I'm totally walking off the plank of ignorance here. But in general, the same thing can be said. The argument I want to make is the same argument that I make for nuclear, for example, in the sense that those technologies, either nuclear or this genetic modification that helps us to absorb carbon, is definitely good from a, or would be good from a climate change perspective, because nuclear is either avoiding emissions or this genetic modification is absorbing carbon from the air and putting it back in the soil. Good. However, they both have other consequences. And until we can develop that kind of technology with reasonable certainty that the risks of implementing them are well below the benefits, then I'm actually a little bit concerned, right? And usually with these kinds of technologies, and that's definitely the case for CCS, carbon capture and storage, we're still at sort of a 50-50. Well, yes, it's beneficial, but yes, it's dangerous, or yes, it's expensive. And so my sense is always, let's go first with the technologies that are unequivocally much more beneficial than they are dangerous. And let's exhaust that, because we have not exhausted all of those technologies. All the renewable energy technologies are barely getting started and barely getting scratched. And eventually, yes, we will probably have to resort to other things. Now, the counter argument that I get from my friends is, well, by the time we need them, we have to have previously invested in them for them to actually be ready to go. I take that argument. I totally understand that way of thinking. But honestly, you know, that goes to my head, but not to my heart. And I like to operate out of both, out of the harmony between my head and my heart. And I'm just really concerned. I'm really concerned about technologies that we don't understand. And I would rather that we push much more into advancing technologies that are really only beneficial. I'm not helpful in that question.
I have two final questions. One is, you use the term criminal a few times, as in it's criminal that we are cutting down forests at the pace that we're doing it. And I wonder whether taking a leaf from the book of people who've done international human rights law, who've thought about these ideas of crimes against humanity and genocide, and work of recent scholars who've thought about these ideas of ecocide, whether because certain forms of environmental degradation are not of consequence just for one nation, but for the entire planet.
And for generations to come.
Precisely. Yes. Whether we shouldn't be enabling an army of lawyers to start saying that ecocide is something that we should begin to think of seriously, and we should begin to attach criminal responsibility for certain forms of environmental harm.
Well, so there is an army of lawyers. That's the good news. And many of those lawyers are right here in London. God bless them. And they're training other lawyers in other countries. And we have not reached the criminal courts yet. Okay, I use that term just because it's so visceral for me. So from a legal point of view, I stand corrected because we have not gotten to the criminal courts yet. Yet. You notice I say yet, right? Because we might. But, you know, last year we had 90 cases around the world of legal cases that were born against companies or governments or, you know, because of climate change. And every year, if you look at the growth of legal cases that are based on climate damages, they're only growing every year. And that's understandable, right? It's understandable because we see more and more negative impact. We see extreme weather events that are growing in their intensity and their frequency, and certainly in their geography. And so that, you know, leads to the situation where there are many lawyers that are digging into finding out who knew what when and who did not do what when. There's a very famous case in Holland where the Dutch government has lost the case, the Urgenda case. And, you know, it's gone through several different iterations. There's a very famous case against the U.S. Government. And, of course, there's a very famous case against Exxon, just to name three of the most famous. But there are 90 cases that are ongoing. And I would not doubt it that we're going to see more of them.
So final question around the intersection between the politics of climate change and the politics of inequality. So let me put something to you and you help me think it through from a political point of view. So we live in a world in which we've never seen, in the industrial world at least, or developed world, such high levels and growing levels of inequality between a very small number of people who control very substantial resources and between a bottom half or a third of a population who's seen no meaningful improvements in their living conditions over the last 30 years, and in some cases a deterioration. And this is compounded by what's happening in the tech space, where we're seeing jobless growth and a very significant displacement of a certain kind of employment away from traditional industries and towards tech. And so there's a group of people having to be retrained and are hurting very badly. And in that context, and we've seen that with the Gilets Jaunes, we've seen it with Australia, we've seen it with some of the politics of the Trump administration, the steps that are necessary to address climate are being used as a cudgel to say we are poor, we are suffering, and the taxes or the steps that we have to take feel like a compounding of the misery that we're currently living in. And it seems to me that progressives or green movements have to engage this argument more effectively if they are to kind of win and keep power and drive the sorts of policies that you've articulated. So help us think that through, because I think that's a big political challenge in our current climate.
It is a big political challenge. I'm very glad that you bring it up, because actually it goes to the heart of our podcast, which is called Outrage and Optimism. Both, right? Because we have to be able to bring both of those sentiments. When I think about climate change, I get both outraged and optimistic. And I don't see them as being mutually exclusive. I see them as focusing on two different aspects that are actually both very full of energy and that can move us forward. And so that's why we focus our podcast, and thank you for inviting me here today, but our podcast is about what is outrageous about what we're doing or not doing, and where is the optimistic piece, and how do you bring those together? So your question takes me exactly to that, to the heart of that. It is, first of all, outrageous that knowing as much about the science that we're knowing, that we have not moved further than we have, and hence you see the outrage in the streets, Extinction Rebellion, the climate strikes on Fridays, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It is also outrageous that fossil fuels have kidnapped the fossil fuel industry, particularly the coal industry, has kidnapped the argument of poverty. And they always, you know, stand up, the coal industry in particular, will stand up and say, we are the only ones that can actually alleviate poverty. Really? Well, if they could do that, they would have done so in the past 100 years, because they have been the predominant fuel of that we have been using in 100 years. So that is absolutely not true. I would argue actually the opposite, and that's where my optimism comes. How incredible is it that the fuels and the technology that we're developing now to meet climate change are actually fuels that will democratize and get to the bottom of the population energy? We have 1.3 billion people around the world who do not have any electricity. Now, when you think about it, just, you know, wipe out electricity out of your life for just 5 minutes and tell me what quality of life you will have. So that is the quality of life. Those are 1.3 billion people that not only don't have electricity, they are the poorest people. They probably don't have running water. The children probably don't go to school. They don't have enough to eat. Probably those mothers are alone standing mothers, and they have to walk for 3 hours to go and get firewood, to then come back 3 hours later, probably being raped on the way, in order to cook food, you know, for their kids. Without electricity, there is no way that you can bring people out of poverty. So renewable energies, you can put a little solar panel on every single little home, no matter where it is. If it is out there in the, you know, farthest corner of Africa, or it is in the most isolated island of an Asian archipelago, it doesn't matter. You can put a little solar panel. That's the beauty of renewables. They're completely distributed. You can also concentrate it. You can do concentrated solar power, and you can get to utility level electricity generation. But they're also, they're so flexible, because you can do both that, the scale, and you can do individual. You can provide electricity to every single family. You do that, you have helped them inordinately with cooking, with lighting at night, kids can study. You begin to bring abject poverty, people who are in abject poverty, up in the line of development and quality of life. And so we really have to understand that, and understand that the yellow vests have come out of a, unfortunately, a very ill-thought policy that put the burden of a climate tax that should have gone to be distributed very differently, put it on those people who should actually be benefited. But if you think of a carbon tax, and I'm very much for a carbon price, where, you know, whether it's a tax or ETS, it doesn't matter. Either way, you put a price on what you don't want, which is carbon, and you generate resources for the government. Where do those resources go? They should go to those people who need it the most. And that would be, you know, the most beneficial economic measure that anyone could do. Because the fact is, those who are polluting are the ones who need it the least. They don't need any break from their taxes, okay? Those that are polluting are doing so because they are corporations, or they are people, you know, like you and me, who live very comfortable lives and who can absolutely afford to pay a carbon tax. And that money should be then distributed to those who need it the most, and who should, and who are suffering the most from climate change. So, you know, it's just about thinking this through carefully. And I'm just very excited about the possibility that addressing climate change is, if you look at, and I'm an anthropologist by training, so I look at the development of humankind over history. And if you just stand back and you say, what does addressing climate change mean for the human race? What it actually means is the first global test on universal solidarity. That's what it means. It is, and I'm very excited about that, because I think that is the challenge of the 21st century. It is about understanding that we can no longer live in this world assuming that the zero-sum game is the operating principle of the world. Forget it. We move beyond the zero-sum game. Once we hit and exceeded planetary boundaries, that just no longer answers any of the problems. We have to get to the point where we understand that we are not just interdependent. We are incredibly interconnected, every single one of us. And that we have to develop not just different technologies, different policies, shifting the capital. This is about something that goes much deeper. This is about who we are as human beings. This is about how do we be, independently of how we do, because doing is actually the second step. It's how do we be ourselves? Who are we when we turn up in the world? What motivates us? And what is the dominant form of thinking and being that is going to be prevalent in this century? And it's no longer, there's no more space for individualistic, competitive thinking and acting. No more space. We have to move to, you know, where we started this whole conversation. Humanity is capable of so much more good than we are seeing right now. And this is the moment in which we're being called up to be our highest selves.
Christiana Figueres, your outrage is palpable. Your optimism is even stronger for everything that you've done in the past, including the historic Paris Agreement, but much more importantly, for everything that you will do in the future. I think the world should be very grateful. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. The podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of inspiring changemakers.